Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, I just want to say thanks to all of you that participated in our Take Back the Flag campaign. Your voices, your pictures, your videos have reminded me and reminded all of us how many patriots there are in the United States who are dedicated like we are to fighting for our democracy. If you still want to participate, send your information to info@lincolnproject.us. Send us your pictures of your flag, your videos, what it means to you. That's info@lincolnproject.us. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by Amy McGrath and Dan Barkoff. Amy is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy and is a retired United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel and F-18 pilot. In 2018 and 2020, respectively, she ran for the United States House and Senate in Kentucky. She's also the founder of Honor Bound, a 501c4 nonpartisan organization committed to leadership development for women with a service background and encouraging those women to run for elected office. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
I'm also joined by Dan Barkoff, also a graduate of Annapolis, a former Navy SEAL, and president of Veterans for Responsible Leadership, a veteran-run super PAC that supports local, state, and federal candidates committed to principled leadership. He's also a graduate of Harvard Medical School because the other things weren't enough, and is now an associate professor and emergency medicine doctor at the University of Vermont. Dan, welcome.
Awesome to be here, Reed. Thanks for having us.
So here we are now. We are in the middle of 2023. You know, as Amy, you noted before we got on, there's nothing happening in the world, at least not politically, not militarily either. And so, guys, from your perspective, and Amy, I'll start with you. As someone who has lived, I assume, in a series of very dynamic environments, how do you sort of parse out, okay, I need to look at this first, I need to look at that second, I need to take a deep breath and say, okay, I've got to work these problems. How do you do that?
Well, first of all, it is difficult because there's so much going on, as you said. I think the one thing that I keep going back to is, why am I here? What are we trying to achieve? And, you know, when I spent 24 years in the military, my job at the end of the day was to protect our country. And so everything else was just fluff, right? I got to get to a position to protect our country, whatever it takes. And now, as I'm out of the military, into politics, and other things. My life, though, is still defined by protecting this country. And what is the biggest threat to our country today? I mean, just in the last few days, we're now watching the news of Donald Trump being indicted on 37 counts of basically leaving our nation's secrets out in the open. That's really big, but it's still not as big as the fact that he led an insurrection on January 6th that wanted to overthrow a free and fair election. And I think that all of these things that we think about that are going on right now, we still, in my mind, have to focus on that. And he is still the biggest threat to our democracy going forward. So that's what I'm thinking now. And I hope that we don't forget about that.
Yeah. And Dan, I want to, you know, expand a little bit on something that Amy said about that, which is, again, you all both served in places that are, to say the least, high risk, right? Either in the cockpit of a fighter pilot or going God knows where to do God knows what with a bunch of your fellow sailors. The intelligence or the information that you are utilizing in your missions derived from not only men and women who work for the United States, but also men and women who are putting their lives in our hands, both individually and collectively, to do that stuff. And so, you know, as Amy talked about, and I want to get back to January 6th, because I know you're involved in a documentary about this, but how do you see that as, you know, some of this stuff is maybe you collected it, right? Or maybe you were the person who was deployed based on it. But how do you see that in a world where, if the United States is supposed to be the beacon of democracy and freedom, and the folks that help us because they believe in it too are afraid to help us because of the outcome, like, how do you square that?
I think it's worth telling the listeners a little bit about how the military classifies information in general, and the government classifies information. So, you know, at your most basic level, you've got something that, quote unquote, is classified or for official use only. An example of that might be, in a military context, even something as simple as the uniform that you're going to wear to the base on Tuesday or something like that. Above that, you've got secret things. Now, an example of a secret thing might be Unit X is going to be, you know, arriving in Iraq on January 1st, and they're going to be there for 6 months. And, you know, this is in general what their mission is. Above that, you've got top secret. And top secret, you're getting into things that would cause true harm to the national security if they were to be disclosed. So an example, hypothetically, of something top secret might be something along the lines of, you know, we're getting information on Reed Galen because we're following him around with his assistant. And beyond that, you get into specific need to know programs. Top secret is the highest classification per se, but once you get into top secret, there's sort of all this world of, you know, different programs that you have to be read in on. So anyone who is in the military, you know, with regard to the documents case, I mean, it is just gobsmacking to think that anyone would leave top secret documents lying around. I mean, these are things that are tightly controlled. These are things that have numbered copies. So, you know, if you're reading a paper copy of something top secret, you know, it says 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, up to however many people are supposed to be in the room, and they're inventoried and accounted for. And, you know, this guy had them on the shower, right? You know, it's funny, just out of curiosity, I went to the Mar-a-Lago website. You know, you can just book a hotel room there, man. And I'm sure people from rival intelligence agencies booked plenty of hotel rooms there. So it is absolute bananas that this occurred. It puts people at risk. You know, foreign intelligence services are good. They're able, you know, to find out, oh, well, if the Americans think this based on this top secret document that was lying in Mar-a-Lago, well, who in Russia has access to this? Well, it's these 10 people. And, you know, they go one by one. And, you know, eventually they get executed. I mean, this is what happened with Robert Hansen and people like this. I mean, this has real consequence for people who are risking their lives for America, whether they're American citizens or not.
So, Amy, you know, in your time in the service, just like Dan had sailors that he was responsible for. You had Marines that you were responsible for. As the commander in chief, it's millions of men and women, whether or not it's families on base or overseas or whatever, right? And that doesn't count the intelligence services and everything else. So talk to me a little bit about what it feels like to have the responsibility knowing that these Marines are my responsibility. Their welfare, I don't know about their happiness, but their safety certainly and security is in my hands. It's my responsibility.
It's an enormous responsibility, and it's something that you don't take lightly as an officer. You know, one of the things that you do from the very beginning when they train you as an officer is obviously you've got to get yourself squared away, but then you're trained to look after those below you. That is your job. And, you know, the fact that we had a commander in chief, and this is a direct result of electing someone who fundamentally does not understand what service is. He's never been in public life, has never done anything for somebody other than himself. That's the difference. You know, in the Marine Corps, officers, we eat last. If there's 12 Marines out there in a squad and you have 11 MREs, you know, you're going to hand out all 11 MREs to everybody else and you don't get one. You're the officer. You know what I mean? You eat last. I mean, that's ingrained in us. It's a trait that good leaders have. Donald Trump never had that and never understood it. And I think his crimes are just so extraordinary. But I do believe that part of it comes down to this idea that, you know, he doesn't fundamentally understand that at all. He thinks that it's weak. And that's into his disparagement of folks who have died for our country and his disparagement of general officers who lead the military.
Or, you know, now icons who've passed on. You know, he likes people that weren't captured. Right. And you as a fighter pilot can appreciate Senator McCain's plight. But Dan, you know, I was rewatching Band of Brothers over the weekend, which even almost 25 years old still holds up. I mean, really still holds up. And there's a scene where Dick Winters, who was the commander of Easy Company, we could do a whole show on him and just leadership ability. And he's talking to one of his platoon leaders, who's an officer, said, and he said, "You're mad at me because I'm getting to know my men?" He said, "No, I'm mad at you because you're putting yourself in a place where you can take from them." you can never be in a place to take from these men. And I thought that just like, you know, of 10 fabulous hours of television, you know, that you see these moments, you know, and even after he said it, the platoon leader didn't get it, but Winters did.
Yeah, that's a great scene. So he's riding back in the Jeep with Buck Compton, and he's talking about, I think they were playing some cards or something like that. And, you know, but it's completely true, right? So the big takeaway from that scene, from Winters' leadership throughout the book and the series, in my opinion, is that leadership is a thoughtful exercise. You know, the military would tell you that leaders are made. You know, there are some people certainly who are born with an innate ability to do that better than others, but it's something that you are trained to do. And the best way to be a leader is to think about leadership, right? To really think and be conscious and thoughtful and try to think about, what am I doing? How is this going to get the best results for the team? How am I as a leader going to get the most out of this team? How am I going to take care of my team? And these are thoughts that, you know, I guarantee that Donald Trump has never had at any point in his life. I mean, I would go one further than Amy. I don't think it's a lack of understanding. It's a complete conscious decision to do the opposite. Donald Trump is uniquely selfish in American history for a public figure, and, you know, perhaps uniquely selfish for anyone who's not serving a life prison term in a federal penitentiary or something like that. But, you know, leadership is something that, it's not that he doesn't get it. He never tried, because he thinks it's bullshit. Like, he thinks it's all bullshit.
Let me lean back on the leadership thing for a second, and we can get back to Trump more. There's one thing that I've been noticing in the political realm, and it's always been there. You guys take it, obviously, to its ultimate extreme, right? Because your lives and those of the people that are under your command are on the line, right? You're not only your own lives, but those of others. You know, there's a reason why you all have basic training, you know, and there's a reason why those bonds in combat become so ingrained in all of you and between one of you. It's that friction that sort of heats up and creates, you know, almost like a super glue, that bond between you. And, you know, it's a weird thing in the United States, because you all have to take people, look, we pride ourselves on like our individualism, right? We pride ourselves on every one of us as an American, right? We're an American. We can do anything because we're an American. But talk a little bit about how you see creating those bonds, because it's not always easy. You know, you bring all of these people into a place where they've rarely been or they've never been before. We have all these disparate personalities. We all think we're the smartest person in the room. So as a leader in the military, how do you get those folks to work together when you know, again, teams are hard. Teams are hard. And I think to Dan's point, it's not like I built the team, now I'm done.
Well, for me, some of it is embracing the individualism of everybody and valuing that, but reminding them that they are a part of the team and we're about the mission. You know, my first roommate at the Naval Academy was a young woman from Queens, New York. You know, we didn't get to choose our roommates. You're assigned. And it is, to that point, it's probably the hardest thing you've ever done is that first summer. Up to that point, you're 18 years old. That's plebe summer, and you're thrown into this cauldron, and it's hard. And, you know, Rachel was from Queens, New York. I'm from Kentucky. We didn't have a whole lot in common. You know, she's a minority from Queens. And you just have to figure it out. And by the end of the summer, we were just two Americans trying to get it done. And we loved our country. We had lots of different views, different family, different background, but we worked to get it done. And that is what you have to do as a leader, is you sort of have to instill and just make sure that everybody is valued. Everybody has a role. We need everybody on this team, and we're all Americans. We all wear the same uniform. And that's what I loved about the military.
So, Dan, now let's talk a little bit about veterans. Tell us a little bit about the documentary that you've been involved in as these men and women are coming home, and what makes them vulnerable. You know, because we know that the VA, you guys probably, I don't know if you still deal with it, but the VA can be challenging. The rate of depression, suicide, PTSD is far too high for men and women who've done so much for us. So tell us a little bit about when those men and women come home, you know, what you're seeing some people taking advantage of.
So a couple of thoughts. We in the military, and we as a culture, spend a lot of time about thinking and transitioning from civilian life to military existence. Okay. We have movies about this. There's Jarhead, there's Full Metal Jacket. We talk about going to boot camp. Kids get ready for boot camp. You know, I know a kid is about to go to Paris Island who, you know, he's running every day and he's doing his pull-ups and all that kind of stuff. And when you get out of the military, after however long you've been in there, some people, you know, 3 years, some people 30 years, you get about a week-long course. There's some PowerPoints that tell you, you know, how to make a resume and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden you're back into it. And, you know, to Amy's point earlier, you know, plebe summer, whether it's plebe summer or boot camp or OCS or the basic school, whatever it is, there's this period of time where at the end of it, you are changed. You've now transitioned to being a soldier, being a sailor, being an airman. And we don't give a whole heck of a lot of thought to transitioning back. And this is a universal problem concept that's been around forever. I mean, it's what the Odyssey is about. You know, Homer wrote about this. He wrote about the transition from war back to peace and how you get lost and, you know, things like this. So the documentary that I was fortunate enough to be included on as an executive producer, I'm not in the doc, it's called Against All Enemies. And we just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival last week. Very, very cool documentary. Ken Harbaugh and Charlie Sadoff and Sebastian Younger were the primary producers and directors of it. And what it's about is it's about veterans joining extremist groups and why that is happening, when it tends to happen, because it's a pattern that has repeated itself throughout American history. And there are certain unique aspects of what's going on today that make some veterans more likely to do it. Now, this is a tiny minority of veterans, but they're overrepresented. I mean, you look at 1-6 and, you know, it was the Oath Keepers. You think of, you know, Stuart Rhodes, who's now in federal prison for 18 years. And, you know, he was a veteran, right? You know, he was not a combat veteran. He shot his eye out on a rifle range as a civilian, but, you know, he wore a uniform. And so what is it that makes some vets susceptible to this? And how is this happening? And what the data shows from, you know, the national domestic terror statistics coming out of places like University of Maryland and the FBI is that these veterans who are joining these groups are getting radicalized at home. It's not occurring when they're in the military. It's not occurring before they join the military. That was a big thing back in the 90s was, you know, white supremacists joining the military to get training of some sort. And that's not really what's happening. I'm sure there are isolated incidences. But what's really happening is folks are getting out. They've now lost their identity for, you know, 12 years or whatever. They were Sergeant Smith. And, you know, they deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. And now the wars are over and they're going home. And they were sort of, you know, the military is pretty good about kind of telling folks, oh yeah, when you get out, everyone's going to want to hire you and all this stuff. And, you know, a lot of folks get out and go back to their hometown and some of them get a job, but maybe it's not a job that provides them with a solid identity. And, you know, then you got some knucklehead friends from your hometown who are like, hey, let's go shoot guns in the woods. Hey, let's, you know, practice some IADs in the woods. Hey, let's go, you know, practice little CQB in this little mock-up thing. And then the next thing you know, they're plotting to kidnap the governor of Michigan. So it's a documentary about how we got here. And this is something that unfortunately has happened over and over again in American history. It happened after the Civil War, the rise of the KKK. It happened after, you know, the heyday of the KKK in the 1920s. It was largely made out of vets from World War I and the Spanish-American War. And then the most modern incarnation of the KKK was a lot of World War II and a lot of Korean War vets. And we don't know what's going to happen right now.
Well, and we saw, Amy, Timothy McVeigh was a perfect example of that. Served in the first Gulf War, came home, was at Waco, right, standing on a hill, watching what goes on in Waco. And then 2 years to the day after Waco, Oklahoma City, you know, happens. But, you know, to expand on Dan's point for a second, just, and I'm sorry, guys, war movies are the only experience I have with the military other than knowing you guys. So pardon my using art, but in The Hurt Locker, I think the best scene of the whole movie is maybe 5 seconds. He's come home from a deployment. His wife sends him to the grocery store and it's a long shot down the aisle of cereal. And there's 80 gajillion types of cereal. And again, Jeremy Renner did a brilliant job, like with the expression on his face. And the next scene is him back in Iraq. He just couldn't handle being at home.
It's real. You know, just to give you two quick stories. One, I had a similar experience of coming home and being overwhelmed. And you don't know when it's going to happen. was early on in 2002, 2003 timeframe before we did a better job of trying to help folks who had gone into combat, give them some time in between when they were there to come home, right? Back in 2002, 2003, we just flew them right back. And I was one of those that went literally from like Afghanistan back to home in like 24-hour period. And I just remember about a week later, just feeling just so overwhelmed that I almost couldn't handle it, you know? And so that was, you know, from the air side and a little bit of the ground side. I can't imagine what it would be like for those that were in it all the time on the ground side. And I think, you know, to Dan's point, when you are somebody who has risked their lives for this country, for our country, you're out there and you believe you're with your whole core, what you're doing is patriotic. And then you come home and, you know, just last week, we found flyers up a few counties south of where I live. It says, join the KKK, join the Klan. You want to fight the gay forces? Do you want to fight the trans people? You know, they list off all of the people that these folks should be mad about. And they say, are you a patriot? If you're a patriot and you want to fight for your country again, join us because we're doing that. We're going to take back our country from these people. And it's all the right wing, far right wing talking points right there on that flyer. And so if you're somebody that just in your whole heart, you know, you love this country, but you can see how easy you can switch from being patriotic wearing the uniform to feeling like, all right, I'm going to fight for my country back home. And here's how I'm going to do it.
Let me ask you this, Amy, because along those lines, was it over the weekend there were a bunch of bona fide neo-Nazis outside Disneyland or Disney World, excuse me, in Orlando, and not one, but two Republican presidential candidates, I'm going to put that in air quotes because they're not really running until they are, gave speeches over the weekend in North Carolina where they promised the crowd that they would change the name of formerly Fort Bragg, named after Braxton Bragg, by all accounts an incompetent Confederate general, but a Confederate general nonetheless, has now been changed to Fort Liberty to sort of, let's say, okay, we should move on from the Confederacy. They promised to change the name back, right? And to your point about January 6th, remember that Lincoln was brilliant in that he never recognized the Confederate States of America, right? To him, it was an armed insurrection against the Union. And Dan, I'll ask you after I ask Amy, as people who have put their lives on the line to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution, what does that say to you?
It's a disgrace. What really fires me up and has fired me up from probably since Donald Trump was elected the first time in 2016 is not so much the rank and file folks being duped into this. It's the leaders. It's the people you just mentioned. The two, you know, Republican presidential candidates, Republican members of Congress who are feeding this and they know better. And that's what makes me so fired up, you know, and it gets back to my main point, which is I'm somebody that has spent my life defending this country and protecting our national security. And this hasn't always been the case, but I do believe now that the Republican Party, because of their leadership, because of who they follow, and because of their actions, is no longer a party that can be trusted with our national security. So I'm going to make it my goal in the next year and a half to make sure that everybody knows that because, you know, it's true.
I mean, Dan, so I did an interview with Newsweek, I think it must have been late last year, and they were asking me what I thought about a second Trump presidency. And I said, well, you know, the first thing they'll do is make sure that all of the power ministries, as they're called, are, you know, taken in hand and are under control. The Department of Justice, which they hate so much, certainly the FBI, the CIA, and the Pentagon. We know for a fact that Donald Trump loathes Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and has very little respect for any of the flag officers, as we saw in various books, because they're not like Hitler's generals, right? Which is such an odd comparison, but okay. So what worries you about that, to Amy's point about the national security of the United States? Because as we saw, right, they're perfectly happy to install people in positions in acting capacities, which, you know, as I say, you know, does this United States Senate have advise and consent power? It does. But also remember that the Constitution is ultimately a piece of paper. If people don't believe in it, it doesn't matter.
So first, I'm going to come right to that, but I just have to throw this out there. So I'm a, you know, a Mainer growing up. Joshua Chamberlain was my guy. I'm a Vermonter now. And I just got to say this, like, you know, the Confederate general statues, those are participation trophies. Those are last place participation trophies. And losing your participation trophy should not make you upset. Okay. So anywho, you know, what could Trump do? I think if Trump were reelected and, you know, he stocked the top part of the DOD with acting, you know, SecDef and things like this and people who are loyal to him. Well, in the military, we're getting awfully close to the worst case scenario in the sense we're relying on the conscience of high level and rank and file military people, to be honest, to recognize the difference between a lawful and an unlawful order. So once we get into that kind of territory, we are darn near some real problems, right? So a lawful order can be an order you disagree with. It can be an order that requires you to risk your life or the lives of your men and women. It can be an order that you hate with all your heart. But if it is given through a proper, you know, command authority and it's not asking you to do something illegal, then it must be followed. Now, an illegal order would be something that requires you to go against either international law or the Constitution itself. So an illegal order would be, you know, to execute the prisoners, right? That is an illegal order. That is an order that is outlawed by the Geneva Convention. An illegal order would be to take the 82nd Airborne and go suppress peaceful protesters in, you know, the square in D.C. Now, I'm not saying that those illegal orders from a second Trump administration would necessarily be followed. In fact, I hope that they would not. I suspect they would not. But you've gotten to a place where, just like happened in Nazi Germany, just like happened in a little village called Mielai, you know, just like happened in all these other examples, you've gotten to a place where we're relying on individuals to have moral courage. When a systems-based approach where we're not relying on individuals as sort of this last bulwark against tyranny.
Here's the other thing we know about, Amy, that we know about movements like this is they'll eventually find somebody who will do what they ask them to, right? And it could be somebody who has one star and thought they should have had a second star. Could be somebody who has, in their own way, you know, Michael Flynn got three frickin' stars, right, before he got canned and became national security advisor before he got canned. And so, like, these people, I assume, you know, this is a little bit dark and I'm sorry to get there, but they do exist, right? In Nixon, right? The Saturday Night Massacre. Eventually somebody at the Justice Department was willing to do it. Jeffrey, what's his name, at Trump's DOJ, right? Eventually he was going to be willing to go along with it. That's my concern, is that there are people who will go along with this because they're also the kinds of people that Dan was talking about, you know, whether or not it's in the 1930s. These people wouldn't have this opportunity otherwise because no one would ever give it to them.
You're exactly right. And the problem is some of the stuff that could be done will do irreparable damage to our military, to our national security. You know, Donald Trump has already said that he would use the military more in domestic matters. It's one of the things he learned from his last stint in the White House. He said, I didn't do it enough. And he's going to find people that do it. And one of the things that we've learned in the years of Trump, I think, is that so much of our system is, as you said, is based on norms, is based on just people of good faith sort of doing the right thing. And some of the stuff is not written down. I mean, the rules of what the military can do on the domestic side are really kind of in the gray area. There are some gray areas there. You know, the pardon power of the presidency, the president pardoning war criminals, he can do that. And why is that a big deal? Well, it's a huge deal. And in the age of Trump, he just seems to push on all of that stuff. You know, a second Donald Trump presidency could be disastrous, not just for that, but because of our alliances. NATO. NATO is the greatest alliance in world history. And that's in my humble opinion, but I think there's a lot to back it up. And, you know, he's disparaging this, wants to tear it apart.
Well, and I would say that, you know, but for Joe Biden, I think he single-handedly saved the alliance in the last 2 years. by bringing all these people together who rarely agree on anything anymore, right? And going and saying, you know, Ukraine is the bulwark of democracy, of liberal freedom, and we're going to do everything we can for them. And I think, I've said this before, I think when Russia invaded Ukraine, all of our NATO and European allies looked back across the Atlantic to see what Joe Biden was going to do. And he said, I'm here. And we're not going anywhere. And I think that single act, Amy, to your point, was enormously important, not only for the Ukrainians, obviously, but for the Europeans and for the liberal democratic order in the country, in the world, not just here. But I think to your point, it starts here. Whether or not Americans want that responsibility, we got it, gang. We are responsible for a lot of stuff because we are the most powerful nation humanity has ever known. Put all of them together, right? We still have more people, more resources, more assets, more capability. And I think in the right hands, more morality and courage than any other nation in history. But it doesn't have to be that way. And that's my concern.
Absolutely. And this is what, you know, Dick Winters and the Greatest Generation fought for and left for us, you know, 150 million people died between 1914 and 1945 in the world wars. And what we have built, what the Greatest Generation has built in this global rules-based order is threatened right now. And it's threatened like we haven't seen before, you know, at least in my lifetime. In my opinion, we owe it to the world to stand up to this aggression. And I cannot imagine what it would have been like had Donald Trump been president.
Dan, let me ask you this about leadership. So about 12 years ago, I went to Normandy. And if you stand on Omaha Beach at low tide, it is a quarter mile of open space to the seawall. And the idea that these young men, and most of them weren't more than 18 or 19, maybe their officers were 22, the ramp dropped, right? And we all remember the scene from Saving Private Ryan. And they had to go across a quarter mile of hell, right, to get there. And they did it. They did it knowing there was a really good chance that they were going to die or be wounded terribly. And they did it. And very few of them, if I can recall, hesitated at the ramp. They went. And so I guess the reason I'm asking that question is, that is, to me, love of country, but it's also love of the men and women to your right and left, right? You're doing it as much for those guys at that point as you are anybody else. But talk about that level of patriotism, because I think patriotism in this country has been wrapped up with nationalism, and they're not the same thing.
The way I view patriotism is I view it as using your gifts, and we all have gifts, and using your time and your talent to make your country a better place. For me, that is patriotism. Now, in the military context, I can tell you when the ramp dropped on Omaha Beach, none of those guys were thinking about waving flags or mom, dad, and apple pie. They were, you know, terrified and trying to drag their buddies, you know, who took a round to the sternum, you know, off the beach, right? So I'm a big believer in kind of decisions made ahead of time and then following through on them. And so, you know, those guys, right, when, you know, the ramp goes down, the decision to storm the beach for them was made in, you know, 1942 when they raised their right hand and joined the army. You know, your decision, Reed, to use your skills and your talents to defend the United States of America was made at some point in 2018, right? Like, you know, and then once you're committed, it's like, well, I'm not, you know, right. I'm committed, right?
I'm here now.
We're here now. This is, there's only one way forward. I can't get back on the boat, right? And I think the three of us, and I'm sure many of our listeners can all relate to that. You know, I think that the hard part of what's being asked of us as a generation, as a nation, is as the living memory of fascism dies off, as the people who literally stormed the beaches at Omaha start to pass away, and there's not many of them left, this stuff has come back around, and requiring it takes both physical, unfortunately, and moral courage. And so, you know, it takes that physical courage of somebody like, you know, Mark Milley, who gets regular death threats.
Or, you know, my favorite exemplar of this is Officer Eugene Goodman.
Exactly.
At the Capitol.
Perfect,
right?
Example.
Who stood there and in a moment knew what he had to do as these guys were charging up the stairs at him. and made the personal decision against his physical safety, Dan, to lead these people away.
Absolutely. And physical courage is admirable. It is difficult to do. It is the easier of the two. And moral courage, which is lonely, and only you know if you pass the test of having moral courage, is harder. And so what we're seeing on the right, I'm with Amy. I mean, there's plenty of people who, there's the lunatic fringe who, you know, are marching in the streets with guns. And yes, that's a concern. That's a problem. But the people who've enabled it by just being unwilling to say, you know, we need to stop this. This is crazy. It's a lack of moral courage.
And Amy, to that point, you ran for office a couple of times, once for House and once for the United States Senate. And now many people who might have been your colleagues, right? They're like, oh, can you believe that they're letting him get away with it again? Like, what would make you think they wouldn't? Again, you mentioned January 6th at the top of the show. If they were willing to let him get away with that, if they were willing to let him get away with all of the insanity of his 4 years in office, right? If they were willing to watch him completely botch the pandemic, right, to the extent that 500,000 Americans die, what would make you think that they're going to stand up now?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes me very sad. Because, you know, I'm somebody that grew up and believed that our political leaders and the leaders in this country, they might be on one side of the aisle or the other, but in general, they put their country above everything else, right? That they swear an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States as a member of Congress. And to see this over and over and over again makes me sad. But I'm also somebody who is an optimist. And when you're talking about patriotism, I do think back to the Greatest Generation. And when I think of patriotism, I think about, okay, not only what Dan said in that moral courage piece, which is so important, and I'll get to that, but I think about what kind of world do we want our children to live in? That's what this is about. I mean, do we want them to grow up in a world where they are proud of their country, where their country is not perfect, but it's going to continue to progress to get better? Do we want them to live in a world where borders are respected, that you can't just invade another country because you're more powerful, like Vladimir Putin, just go in and take over Ukraine? Do we want the rule of law? Do we want them to, you know, care about things like free trade and all of these things? That's part of the entire system that the Greatest Generation gave to us, gave to our generation. Not even to Joe Biden's, to our generation. And we have to take that. I mean, you talk about taking the flag. That's what I'm talking about. Taking the flag and making sure that we protect that for our kids.
Yeah. And on June 1st, we launched our Take Back the Flag campaign, right? Because as I think I've mentioned to you all individually, but a year ago, I was in San Jose at an event and I asked how many people here hang the American flag on their houses. Zero hands go up. Why? I think people will think I'm a Republican. I think people will think I'm a Trump fan. I think people will think I'm a racist, all this other stuff. And to me, again, you know, I consider myself a pretty patriotic guy. And the idea that that's how far, Dan, that symbol has fallen, right? Whether or not it's from the top of Mount Suribachi or from over the Capitol or over the White House or whatever, you know, or in somebody's yard. Like, that's frustrating and upsetting to me.
Full disclosure, I've had a flag above my garage for at least 7 or 8 years now. So I consider myself an early adopter, but it's true, right? The flag is a national symbol. And I suspect all this came from, you know, that cheesy moment where Trump is like hugging the flag on stage and, you know, there's a million pictures of it. And that's pretend, right? That's fake patriotism, performative. You know, Donald Trump doesn't know what the flag represents. I mean, I know guys who were killed in battle, and when they took off their body armor, they had a small little American flag folded up underneath their body armor. That is a true story. That is a national symbol. This is not something that one party owns. This is something that is national. This is something that represents all 50 states, all original 13 colonies. I'm in complete agreement. Let me know what I can do to help, Reed.
Oh, don't you worry. Don't you worry. Well, guys, listen, this has been incredible and there's way too much for me to get to, but I'm going to have you both back on and hopefully we can all actually meet in person at some point sooner than later. Amy, before I let you go, where can our listeners find you online and where can they find your organization?
Well, right now we're in the process of standing up a PAC that is going to amplify the voices of trusted national security leaders. And I'm really excited about this because we have a potential to really help in the next election. So that's going to be titled Operation Saving Democracy. And so look out for that at the end of the summer. But right now, if folks want to support, they can go to amymcgrath.com and you'll see all the different things that I work on, the Secretary of State stuff and Democratic Majority Action PAC. But I really appreciate the opportunity to come on, and we have a responsibility to our country to not give up, to stay in the fight, and to continue. So that's what we're doing.
Amen. And Dan, how about you?
If you want to find me, so I've quit all algorithmic social media for a while now, Reid, but VFRL.org, that's VFRL.org. That's the website of our organization. It's a great organization. You know, we're still all volunteer. We're doing good things. If you want to check it out, please do. You also can find some of my writing on Resolute Square. And on Resolute Square, they're going to be hosting the VFRL podcast, which will be coming out very soon. We've got some great guests. We've got Adrian LaFrance and James Stavridis and Mark Hertling and Nick Francona and Steve Kornacki, my friend, came on. And it's going to be really fun. We've got some later in the summer. We're going to do Ann Applebaum and Seth Moulton and things like that. So it's going to be a really fun show. Please check it out.
Well, good. Yeah, check it out, gang. As always, you can find me on Twitter and TikTok. I'm at the most algorithmic social media, Dan, at Reid Galen, and on Instagram at Reid_Galen_LP. Amy McGrath, Dan Barkoff, first, thanks for joining me. As always, thanks to you and your soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, everybody out there who is doing their part and has done their part for us. And we'll see you next time. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter, at Project Lincoln. And for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reid Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.